full to my ass, and he groans as he lifts my nightgown. I rise a little, so that he can free himself, and then I lower myself on top of him, taking him in. We make love, cocooned under a blanket, with the sound of the ocean as our background song. It's the perfect moment, in a perfect place with the perfect person. And I know without a doubt that I'll be writing about this moment when I write my love letter to him. Chapter 22. Now. He kissed another woman. I stare at the text I'm about to send Ava, but then I remember she's several hours ahead where she lives. I would feel bad knowing this is the text she'll wake up to. I delete it. It's been half an hour since Graham gave up and went back inside, but I'm still sitting in my car. I think I'm too wounded to move. I have no idea if any of this is my fault or if it's his fault or if it's no one's fault. The only thing I know is that he hurt me, and he hurt me because I've been hurting him. It doesn't make what he did right in any sense, but a person can understand a behavior without excusing it. Now we're both full of so much pain, I don't even know where to go from here. No matter how much you love someone, the capacity of that love is meaningless if it outweighs your capacity to forgive. Part of me wonders if we'd even be having any of these problems if we would have been able to have a baby. I'm not sure that our marriage would have taken the turn it did, because I would have never been as devastated as I've been the last few years. And Graham wouldn't have had to walk on eggshells around me. But then part of me wonders if this was inevitable. Maybe a child wouldn't have changed our marriage, and instead of just being an unhappy couple, we would have been an unhappy family. And then what would that make us? Just another married couple staying together for the sake of the children? I wonder how many marriages would have survived if it weren't for the children they created together. How many couples would have continued to live together happily without the children being the glue that holds their family together? Maybe we should get a dog. See if that fixes us. Maybe that's exactly what Graham was thinking when he sat in my car earlier and said, "Why did we never get a dog?" Of course, that's what he was thinking. He's just as aware of our problems as I am. It only makes sense our minds would head in the same direction. When it grows too cold in the car, I walk back into our house and sit on the edge of the sofa. I don't want to go to my bedroom where Graham is sleeping. A while ago, he was screaming that he loves me at the top of his lungs. He was so loud, I'm sure all the neighbors woke up to the sound of him yelling and the pounding of his fist against metal. But right now, our house is silent. And that silence between us is so loud, I don't think I'll ever be able to fall asleep. We've tried therapy in the past, hoping it would help with the infertility issues we struggled with. I got bored with it. He got bored with it. And then we bonded over how boring therapy was. Therapists do nothing but try to make you recognize the wrongs within yourself. That's not Graham's issue, and it's not my issue. We know our faults. We recognize them. My fault is that I can't have a baby, and it makes me sad. Graham's fault is that he can't fix me, and it makes him sad. There's no magical cure that therapy will bring us. No matter how much we spend on trying to fix our issue, no therapist in the world can get me pregnant. Therefore, therapy is just a drain on a bank account that has already had one too many leaks. Maybe the only cure for us is divorce. It's weird, having thoughts of divorcing someone I'm in love with. But I think about it a lot. I think about how much time Graham is wasting by being with me. He would be sad if I left him, but he'd meet someone new. He's too good not to. He'd fall in love, and he could make a baby, and he'd be able to rejoin that circle of life that I ripped him out of. When I think about Graham being a father someday, it always makes me smile, even if the thought of him being a father doesn't include me being a mother. I think the only reason I never completely let him go is because of the miracles. I read the articles, and the books, and the blog posts from the mothers who tried to conceive for years, and then just as they were about to give up, voila, pregnant. The miracles gave me hope. Enough hope to hang on to Graham just enough in case we ever got a miracle of our own. Maybe that miracle would have fixed us, put a band-aid on our broken marriage. I want to hate him for kissing someone else, but I can't, because part of me doesn't blame him. I've been giving him every excuse in the world to walk out on me. We haven't had sex in a while, but I know that's not why he strayed outside of our marriage. Graham would go a lifetime without sex if I needed him to. The reason he allowed himself to fuck up is because he gave up on us. Back when I was in college, I was assigned to do an article on a couple who had been married for 60 years. They were both in their 80s. When I showed up to the interview, I was shocked at how in tune they were with each other. I assumed, after living with someone for 60 years, you'd be sick of them. But they looked at each other like they still somehow respected and admired each other, even after all they'd been through. I asked them a number of questions during the interview, but the question I ended the interview with left such an impact on me. I asked, "What's the secret to such a perfect marriage?" The old man leaned forward and looked at me very seriously.
"Our marriage hasn't been perfect. No marriage is perfect. There were times when she gave up on us. There were even more times when I gave up on us. The secret to our longevity is that we never gave up at the same time."
I'll never forget the honesty in that man's answer. And now I truly feel like I'm living that. I believe that's why Graham did what he did, because he finally gave up on us. He's not a superhero. He's human. There isn't a person in this world who could put up with being shut out for as long as Graham has put up with it. He has been our strength in the past, and I've continually been our weakest link. But now the tables have turned, and Graham was momentarily our weakest link. The problem is, I feel like I've given up too. I feel like we've both given up at the same time, and there may be no turning back from that. I know I could fix it by forgiving him and telling him I'll try harder, but part of me wonders if that's the right choice. Why fight for something that will likely never get better? How long can a couple cling to a past they both prefer in order to justify a present where neither of them is happy? There is no doubt in my mind that Graham and I used to be perfect for each other. But just because we used to be perfect for each other doesn't mean we're perfect together now. We're far from it. I look at the clock, wishing it would magically fast-forward through tomorrow. I have a feeling tomorrow is going to be so much worse than today was, because tomorrow I feel like we'll be forced to make a decision. We'll have to decide if it's finally time to open that wooden box. The thought of it makes my stomach turn. A pain rips through me, and I clench at my shirt as I lean forward. I am so heartbroken, I can actually physically feel it. But I don't cry, because in this situation, my tears cause me even more pain. I walk to our bedroom with dry eyes. It's the longest stretch of time I've gone in the last 24 hours without crying. I push open our bedroom door, expecting Graham to be asleep. Instead, he's sitting up against the headboard. His reading glasses are at the tip of his nose, and he's holding a book in his lap. His bedside lamp is on, and we make eye contact for a brief second. I crawl in bed beside him, my back turned to him. I think we're both too broken tonight to even continue the argument. He continues reading his book, and I do my best to try to fall asleep. My mind runs, though. Several minutes pass, and just knowing he's right next to me prevents me from relaxing. He must realize I'm still awake, because I hear him as he closes his book and places it on the nightstand.
"I quit my job today."
I don't say anything in response to his confession. I just stare at the wall.
"I know you think I left for work this morning, and that I just left you here locked up in this bedroom."
He's right. That's exactly what I thought.
"But I only left the house because I needed to quit my job. I can't work in the place where I made the worst mistake of my life. I'll start looking for a new job next week."
I squeeze my eyes shut and pull the covers up to my chin. He turns out the lamp, indicating he doesn't need a response from me. After he rolls over, I let out a quiet sigh, knowing he won't be working around Andrea anymore. He stopped giving up. He's trying again. He still believes there's a possibility that our marriage will go back to how it used to be. I feel sorry for him. What if he's wrong? These thoughts plague me for the next hour. Graham somehow falls asleep. Or I think he's asleep. He's playing the part well. But I can't sleep. The tears keep threatening to fall, and the pain in my stomach gets worse and worse. I get up and take some aspirin, but when I'm back in the bed, I start to question whether emotional turmoil can actually manifest as physical pain. Something isn't right. It shouldn't hurt this much. I feel a sharp pain, a deep pain, a pain strong enough to force me onto my side. I clench my fists around my blanket and curl my legs up to my stomach. When I do this, I feel it, slippery and wet, all over the sheets. Graham. I try to reach for him, but he's rolling over to turn on the light. Another pain, so profound it makes me gasp for breath.
Quinn?
His hand is on my shoulder. He pulls the covers away. Whatever he sees sends him flying off the bed. The lights are on. He's picking me up, telling me it'll be okay. He's carrying me. We're in the car. He's speeding. I'm sweating. I look down. I'm covered in blood. Graham? I'm terrified, and he takes my hand and he squeezes it and he says,
"It's okay, Quinn. We're almost there. We're almost there."
Everything after that runs together. There are glimpses of things that stick out to me. The fluorescent light over my head, Graham's hand around mine. Words I don't want to hear, like miscarriage and hemorrhaging and surgery. Words Graham is saying into the phone, probably to his mother, while he holds my hand. He whispers them because he thinks I might be asleep. Part of me is, most of me isn't. I know these aren't things he's saying might happen. They've already happened. I'm not going into surgery. I've just come out of it. Graham ends the call. His lips are against my forehead, and he whispers my name.
Quinn.
I open my eyes to meet his. His eyes are red, and there's a deep wrinkle between his brows that I've never noticed before. It's new, probably brought on by what's currently happening. I wonder if I'll think of this moment every time I look at that wrinkle.
What happened?
The crease between his eyes deepens. He brushes his hand over my hair and carefully releases his words.
"You had a miscarriage last night," he confirms.
His eyes search mine, preparing for whatever reaction I might have. It's weird that my body doesn't feel it. I know I'm probably heavily medicated, but it seems like I would know that there was a life growing inside of me that is no longer there. I put a hand on my stomach, wondering how I missed it. How long had I been pregnant? How long has it been since we last had sex? Over 2 months. Closer to three.
"Graham," I whisper.
He takes my hand and squeezes it. I know I should be full of so much devastation right now that not even a sliver of happiness or relief could find its way into my soul. But somehow, I don't feel the devastation that should accompany this moment. I feel hope. I was pregnant? We finally got pregnant? I don't know how I'm focusing on the only positive thing about this entire situation, but after years of constant failure, I can't help but take this as a sign. I got pregnant. We had a partial miracle. A tear slips out of Graham's eye and lands on my arm. I look down at the tear and watch it slide over my skin. My eyes flick back up to Graham's, and not a single part of him is able to see the positive in this situation.
Quinn.
Another tear falls from his eye. In all the years I've known him, I've never seen him look this sad. I shake my head, because whatever has him this terrified to speak is not something I want to hear. Graham squeezes my hand again and looks at me with so much devastation in his eyes, I have to turn away from him when he speaks.
When we got here last night.
I try to stop listening, but my ears refuse to fail me.
You were hemorrhaging.
The word "no" is repeating, and I have no idea if it's coming from my mouth or if it's inside my head.
You had to have a...
I curl up and hug my knees, squeezing my eyes shut. As soon as I hear the word hysterectomy, I start crying. Sobbing. Graham crawls into the hospital bed and wraps himself around me, holding me, as we let go of every single ounce of hope that was left between us. Chapter 23. Then. It's our last night at the beach house. We leave in the morning to head back to Connecticut. Graham has a meeting he has to be back for tomorrow afternoon. I have laundry to do before I go back to work on Tuesday. Neither of us is ready to leave yet. It's been peaceful and perfect, and I'm already looking forward to coming back here with him. I don't even care if I have to kiss my mother's ass for the next month in order to plan our next getaway. It's a price I'll gladly pay for another weekend of perfection. It's a little bit colder tonight than the last two nights we've been here, but I kind of like it. I have the heater turned up high in the house. We freeze our asses off for hours near the fire pit, and then cuddle up in bed to thaw out. It's a routine I would never get bored of. I just finished making us both cups of hot chocolate. I take them outside and hand Graham his, then sit down next to him.
Okay, he says. Next question.
Graham found out this morning that even though I love looking at it, I've never actually stepped foot in the ocean. He spent the majority of the day trying to figure out other things about me that he didn't know. It's become a game to us now, and we're alternating questions so we can find out everything there is to know about each other. He mentioned the first night we were together that he doesn't talk about religion or politics. But it's been 6 months now, and I'm curious to know his opinions. We've still never discussed religion, I say. Or politics. Are those still topics that are off the table? Graham edges the cup with his lips and sucks a marshmallow into his mouth.
What do you want to know?
Are you a Republican or a Democrat? He doesn't even hesitate.
Neither. I can't stand the extremists on either side, so I sort of hover in the middle.
So you're one of those people. He tilts his head.
What people?
The kind who pretend to agree with every opinion just to keep the peace? Graham arches an eyebrow.
Oh, I have opinions, Quinn. Strong ones.
I pull my legs up and tuck them under me, facing him. I want to hear them.
What do you want to know?
Everything, I challenge. Your stance on gun control, immigration, abortion, all of it. I love the look of excitement on his face, as if he's preparing for a presentation. It's adorable that a presentation would even excite him. He sets his mug of hot chocolate on the table beside him.
Okay, let's see. I don't think we should take away a citizen's right to own a gun, but I do think it should be one hell of a difficult process to get your hands on one. I think women should decide what to do with their own bodies, as long as it's within the first trimester or it's a medical emergency. I think government programs are absolutely necessary, but I also think a more systematic process needs to be put in place that would encourage people to get off of welfare, rather than to stay on it. I think we should open up our borders to immigrants, as long as they register and pay taxes. I'm certain that life-saving medical care should be a basic human right, not a luxury only the wealthy can afford. I think college tuition should automatically be deferred, and then repaid over a 20-year period on a sliding scale. I think athletes are paid way too much, teachers are paid way too little, NASA is underfunded, weed should be legal, people should love who they want to love, and Wi-Fi should be universally accessible and free.
When he's finished, he calmly reaches for his mug of hot chocolate and brings it back to his mouth.
Do you still love me?
More than I did 2 minutes ago. I press a kiss to his shoulder, and he wraps his arm around me, tucking me against him.
Well, that went better than I thought it would.
Don't get too comfortable, I warn. We still haven't discussed religion. Do you believe in God? Graham breaks eye contact and looks out at the ocean. He caresses my shoulder and thinks about my question for a moment.
I didn't used to.
But you do now?
Yeah, I do now.
What changed your mind?
A few things, he says.
He nudges his head toward the ocean,
that being one of them. How can something exist that is that magnificent and powerful without something even more magnificent and powerful creating it?
I stare out at the water with him when he asks me what I believe. I shrug. Religion isn't one of my mother's strong suits, but I've always believed there was something out there greater than us. I just don't know exactly what it is. I don't think anyone knows for sure. That's why they call it faith, he says. So how does a man of math and science reconcile his knowledge with his faith? Graham smiles when I ask him that question, like he's been dying to discuss it. I love that about him. He has this adorable inner nerd that appears sometimes, and it makes him even more attractive.
Do you know how old the Earth is, Quinn?
No, but I bet I'm about to find out.
4.5 billion years old,
he says. His voice is full of wonder, like this is his absolute favorite thing to talk about.
Do you know how long ago our specific species appeared?
No idea.
Only 200,000 years ago, he says.
Only 200,000 years out of 4.5 billion years.
It's unbelievable.
He grabs my hand and lays it palm down on his thigh. He begins tracing over the back of my hand with a lazy finger.
If the back of your hand represented the age of this Earth and every species that has ever lived, the entire human race wouldn't even be visible to the naked eye. We are that insignificant.
He drags his fingers to the center of the back of my hand and points to a small freckle.
From the beginning of time until now, we could combine every single human that has ever walked this earth, and all their problems and concerns as a whole wouldn't even amount to the size of this freckle right here.
He taps my hand.
Every single one of your life experiences could fit right here in this tiny freckle. So would mine. So would Beyoncé's.
I laugh.
When you look at the Earth's existence as a whole, we're nothing. We haven't even been here long enough to earn bragging rights.
Yet humans believe we're the center of the universe. We focus on the stupidest, most mundane issues. We stress about things that mean absolutely nothing to the universe, when we should be nothing but grateful that evolution even gave our species a chance to have problems.
Because one of these days, humans won't exist. History will repeat itself, and the Earth will move on to a different species altogether. Me and you were just two people out of an entire race that, in retrospect, is still way less impressive at sustainability than a dinosaur. We just haven't reached our expiration date yet.
He slides his fingers through mine and squeezes my hand.
Based on all the scientific evidence that proves how insignificant we are, it was always hard for me to believe in God. The more appropriate question would have been, could a God believe in me? Because a lot has happened on this Earth in 4.5 billion years to think that a God would give a shit about me or my problems. But I recently concluded that there's no other explanation for how you and I could end up on the same planet, in the same species, in the same century, in the same country, in the same state, in the same town, in the same hallway, in front of the same door, for the same reason at the exact same time. If God didn't believe in me, then I'd have to believe you were just a coincidence. And you being a coincidence in my life is a lot harder for me to fathom than the mere existence of a higher power.
Oh. Wow. I'm breathless. Graham has said so many sweet things to me, but this wasn't sweet. This was pure poetry. This was beyond an expression of his intelligence, because I know he's incredibly smart. This was sacrificial. He gave me purpose. He made me incredibly relevant, crucial to him, when I've never felt relevant, vital, or crucial to anyone else before.
I love you so much, Graham Wells.
It's all I can say, because I can't compete with what he just said. I don't even try.
Do you love me enough to marry me?
I lift off his arm and sit up straight, still facing him. Did he seriously just ask me that?
It was so spontaneous. He probably hasn't even thought it through. He's still smiling, but in a few seconds I think he's probably going to laugh because he accidentally blurted it out without even thinking. He doesn't even have a ring, which proves it was an accident.
Graham.
He slips his hand under the blanket. When he pulls his hand back out, he's holding a ring. No box, no gift wrap, no pretenses. It's just a ring. A ring he's been carrying in his pocket for a moment he obviously did think through. I bring my hands up to my mouth. They're shaking because I wasn't expecting this,
and I'm speechless, and I'm scared I won't be able to answer him out loud because everything is caught in my throat, but I somehow still whisper the words, "Oh my God."
Graham pulls my left hand from my mouth, and he holds the ring near my ring finger, but he doesn't attempt to slip it on. Instead, he dips his head to bring my focus back to him. When our eyes meet, he's looking at me with all the clarity and hope in the world.
"Be my wife, Quinn. Weather the Category 5 moments with me."
I'm nodding before he's even finished speaking. I'm nodding because if I try to say yes, I'll start crying. I can't even believe he somehow made this perfect weekend even better. As soon as I start nodding, he laughs with a heavy sigh of relief. And when he slips the ring on my finger, he bites his lip because he doesn't want me to see that he's getting choked up too.
"I didn't know what ring to get you," he says, looking back up at me. "But when the jeweler told me that the wedding ring symbolizes an endless loop without a beginning, middle, or end, I didn't want to break up that endless loop with diamonds.
I hope you like it." The ring is a delicate, thin gold band with no stones. It's not a reflection of how much money Graham has or doesn't have. It's a reflection of how long he believes our love will last. An eternity. "It's perfect, Graham."
Chapter 24. Now.
"Cervical ectopic pregnancy," she says. "Very rare. In fact, the chances of a woman experiencing this type of ectopic pregnancy are less than 1%.
Graham squeezes my hand. I lay back in the hospital bed, wanting nothing more than for the doctor to leave the room so I can go back to sleep. The medicine has me so drowsy it's hard to pay attention to everything she's saying. I know I don't have to, though, because Graham is focused on every word that comes out of her mouth.
"Bed rest for 2 weeks," is the last thing I hear her say before I close my eyes. I know Graham is the one who loves math, but I feel like I'm going to be obsessing over that less than 1%. The chances of me getting pregnant after so many years of trying were greater than the chances of a pregnancy resulting in a cervical ectopic abruption.
"What was the cause?" Graham asks.
"More than likely the endometriosis," she replies. She goes into a little more detail, but I tune her out. I tilt my head toward Graham and open my eyes. He's staring at the doctor, listening to her response. But I can see the worry in him. His right hand is covering his mouth. His left hand still has a grip on mine.
"Could,"
he glances down at me and there is so much worry in his eyes.
"Could stress have caused the miscarriage?"
"Miscarriage was inevitable with this type of pregnancy," she says. "Nothing could have been done to prolong it. It ruptured because ectopic pregnancies aren't viable." My miscarriage happened 19 hours ago. It isn't until this moment that I realize Graham has spent the last 19 hours thinking he was somehow responsible. He's been afraid that the stress from our fight led to this. After the doctor leaves the room, I brush my thumb across his hand. It's a small gesture, and one that is very hard to make due to the amount of anger I still hold, but one he notices immediately.
"You have a lot to feel guilty for, but my miscarriage is not one of them."
Graham stares at me a moment, with vacant eyes and a broken soul. Then he releases my hand and walks out of the room. He doesn't come back for half an hour, but it looks like he's been crying. He's cried a few times during our marriage. I've never actually seen him cry until yesterday, but I've seen him in the aftermath. Graham spends the next few hours making sure I'm comfortable. My mother comes to visit, but I pretend to be asleep. Ava calls, but I tell Graham to tell her I'm asleep. I spend most of the day and night trying not to think about everything that's happening, but every time I close my eyes, I find myself wishing I would have just known. Even if the pregnancy would have ended the same way, I'm angry with myself for not paying more attention to my body so I could have enjoyed it while it lasted. If I had paid more attention, I would have suspected I was pregnant. I would have taken a test. It would have been positive. And then, just once, Graham and I would have known what it felt like to be parents, even if it would have been a fleeting feeling. It's a little morbid that I would go through this entire thing again,
If I could have just known I was pregnant for one single day. After so many years of trying, it seems cruel that our payoff was a miscarriage followed by a hysterectomy without the cushion of feeling like parents, if even for a moment. The entire ordeal has been unfair and painful, more so than my recovery will be. Because of the rupture and the hemorrhaging, the doctors had to perform an emergency abdominal hysterectomy, rather than a vaginal one, which means a longer recovery time. I'll likely be in the hospital another day or two before I'll be discharged. Then I'll be confined to our bed for 2 weeks. Everything feels so unfinished between us. We hadn't resolved anything before the miscarriage, and now it just feels like the decision we were about to make has been put on hold. Because I'm in no place to discuss the future of our marriage right now. It'll probably be weeks before things are back to normal. As normal as things can get without a uterus.
You can't sleep? Graham asks.
He hasn't left the hospital all day. He only left the room earlier for half an hour, but then he returned and has been alternating between the couch and the chair next to my bed. Right now he's in the chair, seated on the edge of it, waiting for me to speak. He looks exhausted, but I know Graham, and he isn't going anywhere until I do.
Do you want something to drink?
I shake my head. I'm not thirsty. The only light on in the room is the one behind my bed, and it makes it look like Graham is in a spotlight on a lonely stage. His need to console me is warring with his awareness of the tension that's been between us for so long. But he fights the tension and reaches for the rail.
Do you mind if I lay with you?
He already has the rail down and is crawling into the bed with me when I shake my head. He's careful to turn me so that my IV doesn't pull. He fits himself into less than half the bed next to me and slips a hand under my head, sacrificing his comfort for mine. He kisses me on the back of my head. Part of me wasn't sure I wanted him in the bed with me, but I soon realized that falling asleep in our shared sadness is somehow more comforting than falling asleep alone. I'm flying home, Ava blurts out before I even have the chance to say hello. No, you aren't. I'm fine. Quinn, I'm your sister. I want to come stay with you. No, I repeat. I'll be fine. You're pregnant. The last thing you need is to spend all day on an airplane. She sighs heavily. Besides, I add, I'm thinking about coming to visit you instead. It's a lie. I haven't thought about it until this very moment. But my impending 2 weeks on bed rest makes me realize how much I'll need to put space between our house and myself when I'm finally recovered. Really? Can you? When do you think you'll be released to fly? I'll ask the doctor when she discharges me. Please don't say that if you aren't serious. I am serious. I think it'll do me some good. What about Graham? Won't he be using all his vacation time during your recovery? I don't talk about my marriage troubles to anyone, not even Ava. I want to come alone, I say. I don't elaborate. I haven't told her Graham quit his job, and I didn't tell her about him kissing another woman. But by the pause Ava gives me, I can tell she knows something is up. I'll wait to tell her about everything until I actually see her in person. Okay, she says. Talk to your doctor and let me know a date. Okay. Love you. Love you, too. After I end the call, I look up from the hospital bed to see Graham standing in the doorway. I wait for him to tell me it's not a good idea to plan travel after just having surgery. Instead, he just looks down at the coffee cup in his hand.
You're going to visit Ava?
He doesn't say we. Part of me feels guilty, but surely he understands that I need space. Not until I get cleared to fly. But yeah, I need to see her. He doesn't look up from his cup. He just nods a little and says,
Are you coming back?
Of course.
Of course.
I don't say it with a lot of conviction, but there's enough in my voice to assure him that this isn't a separation. It's just a break. He swallows heavily.
How long will you be gone?
I don't know. Maybe a couple of weeks? Graham nods, and then takes a sip from his cup while kicking off the door.
We have some airline miles on our card. Let me know when you want to leave, and I'll book your flight.
Chapter 25. Then. I don't remember Ethan's and my wedding plans being this stressful. That might have been because I let my mother take the reins back then and had very little to do with the planning. But this is different. I want Graham and I to decide on what flavor of cake we want. I want Graham and I to decide who to invite, and where it should be, and what time of day we want to commit to each other for the rest of our lives. But my mother won't stop making decisions that I don't want her to make, no matter how many times I ask her to stop. "I just want your day to be perfect, Quinn," she says. "Graham can't afford these things, so I'm only trying to help out," she says. "Don't forget to have him sign a prenup," she says. "You never know if your stepfather will leave you an inheritance," she says. "You need to protect your assets." She says things that make me feel like marriage is nothing more than a loan to her, rather than a commitment of love. She's brought up the idea of a prenuptial agreement so many times, she forgets that as it stands, I have no assets to protect. Besides, I know Graham isn't marrying me for the money or property my stepfather may or may not leave me one day. Graham would marry me even if I were up to my eyeballs in debt. I feel myself starting to resent the whole idea of a lavish wedding. I would vent my frustration to Graham, but if I did that, I'd have to tell him why my mother is frustrating me. The last thing I want to do is share with Graham all the underhanded things my mother says about him. I look down at my phone as another text comes through from my mother. "You should rethink the buffet, Quinn. Evelyn Bradbury hired a private chef for her wedding, and it was so much classier." I roll my eyes and flip my phone over, so I won't be subjected to more of her texts. I hear the front door to my apartment close, so I grab my brush. I pretend I'm just brushing my hair, rather than moping in the bathroom, when Graham walks in. The sight of him alone instantly calms me. My frustration is now long gone and replaced with a smile. Graham wraps his arms around me from behind and kisses me on the neck. "Hey, beautiful." He smiles at me in the mirror. "Hey, handsome." He spins me around and gives me an even better kiss.
"How was your day?"
"Fine. How was yours?"
"Fine."
I push against his chest, because he's staring at me too hard, and I might accidentally let my true emotions out, and then he'll ask me what's wrong, and I'll have to tell him how much this wedding is stressing me out.
I turn around and face the mirror, hoping he'll go to the living room, or the kitchen, or anywhere that isn't somewhere he can stare at me like he's staring at me right now.
"What's bothering you?"
Sometimes I hate how well he knows me. Except during sex. It comes in handy during sex. "Why can't you be oblivious to a woman's emotional state like most men?"
He smiles and pulls me to him.
"If I was oblivious to your emotional state, I would merely be a man in love with you. But I'm more than that. I'm your soulmate, and I can feel everything you're feeling."
He presses his lips to my forehead.
"Why are you sad, Quinn?"
I sigh, exasperated.
"My mother."
He releases me, and I walk to the bedroom and sit on my bed. I fall backward and stare up at the ceiling. She's trying to turn our wedding into the wedding she had planned for me and Ethan. She's not even asking me what we want, Graham. She's just making decisions and telling me after the fact.
Graham crawls onto the bed and lays beside me, propping his head up on his hand. He rests his other hand on my stomach. "Yesterday, she told me she put down a deposit at the Douglas Wimberley Plaza for the date of our wedding. She's not even asking what we want, but because she's paying for everything, she thinks it earns her the right to make all the decisions. Today, she texted and said she ordered the invitations."
Graham makes a face.
"You think that means our wedding invitations will have the word prestigious in them?"
I laugh. I'd be more shocked if they didn't. My head flops to the side, and I give him the most pathetic look, short of pouting. I don't want a huge wedding in a fancy plaza with all my mother's friends there.
"What do you want?"
At this point, I don't even know that I want a wedding. Graham tilts his head, a little concerned by my comment. I quickly rectify it.
I don't mean I don't want to marry you. I just don't want to marry you in my mother's dream wedding. Graham gives me a reassuring smile.
We've only been engaged for 3 months. We still have 5 months before the wedding date.
There's plenty of time to put your foot down and make sure you get what you want. If it'll make things easier for you, just blame everything on me. Tell her I said no, and she can hate me for ruining her dream wedding while keeping the peace between the two of you.
Why is he so perfect?
You really don't care if I blame you?
He laughs. Quinn, your mother already hates me. This will give her a little more justification for her hatred, and then everyone wins.
He stands up and slips off his shoes.
We going out tonight?
Whatever you want to do. Ava and Reed are ordering some kind of fight on pay-per-view and invited us over. Graham undoes his tie.
That sounds fun. I have some emails I need to send, but I can be ready in an hour.
I watch as he leaves the room. I fall back onto the bed and smile, because it feels like he just might have come up with a solution to some of my issues in less than 2 minutes. But even though the solution sounds like a good one, just blame Graham for everything, my mother will never go for it. She'll just point out that Graham isn't paying for the wedding, so Graham doesn't get a say.
But still, he tried to solve my issues. That's what counts, right?
He's willing to take the blame for something just to keep the peace between my mother and me.
I can't believe I get to marry that man in 5 months. I can't believe I get to spend the rest of my life with him. Even if that life together will start in the Douglas Wimberley Plaza, surrounded by people I barely know, and food that's so expensive, it guarantees ample trays full of raw meat and ceviche that no one actually likes to eat, but pretends to because it's fancy.
Oh well. The wedding may not be ideal, but it will only be a few painful hours, followed by a lifetime of perfection. I drag myself off the bed, committed to somehow remaining sane for the next 5 months. I spend the next half hour getting ready for our night out. Graham and I have a handful of friends we sometimes spend time with on the weekends, but we mostly spend our time with Ava and Reed. They got married just before I met Graham.
Ava was smart. She married Reed on a whim in Vegas.
My mother wasn't able to order her invitations or book her venue or even choose which cake tasted best to her. I was the only one who knew they were jetting off to Vegas to get married, and I've secretly been envious of their decision. I'm buttoning my jeans when Graham walks into the bathroom.
Are you ready?
Almost. Let me grab some shoes. I walk to my closet and Graham follows me in there. He leans against the doorway and watches me while I look for a pair of shoes. I have to dress up for work every day, so a lazy night at Ava and Reed's is a nice respite from the heels and business attire I wear daily. I'm looking through all the shoes on my shelf, trying to find my favorite comfy pair. Graham is watching me the whole time. I glance at him a couple of times, and I can't help but think he's up to something. There's a smirk on his face. It's barely there, but it's there.
What is it?
He unfolds his arms and slides his hands into the pockets of his jeans.
What if I told you I just spent the last half hour reworking the plans for our wedding?
I stand up straight. He definitely has all my attention now. What do you mean?
He inhales a breath, like he's trying to calm his nerves. Knowing he's nervous about whatever he's about to say makes me nervous for what he's about to say. I don't care about the details of our wedding, Quinn. We can have whatever kind of wedding you want, as long as the final result is that you'll be my wife. But,
he walks into my closet and pauses a foot away from me.
If the only thing you want from this wedding is me, then why are we waiting? Let's just go ahead and get married. This weekend.
Before I can speak, he grabs my hands and squeezes them.
I just booked the beach house through next Monday. I spoke to a minister who is willing to come marry us there. He'll even bring a witness so we don't have to tell anyone. It'll just be you and me. We'll get married by the ocean tomorrow afternoon, and then tomorrow night, we can sit by the fire where I propose to you. We'll spend the whole night eating s'mores and asking each other questions, and then we'll make love and fall asleep and wake up married on Sunday.
I'm almost as speechless as I was the moment he proposed to me. And just like 3 months ago when I was too excited and shocked to say yes, I nod, profusely, and I laugh and I hug and I kiss him. It's perfect. It's perfect. I love you. It's perfect. We grab a suitcase out of my closet and start packing. We decide we aren't telling anyone, not even his mother. We can call them tomorrow, after we're married, Graham says. I can't stop smiling, even though I know my mother is going to completely lose it when I call her tomorrow night and tell her we're already married. My mother is going to kill us.
Yes, she probably will. But it's a lot easier to ask for forgiveness than permission.
Chapter 26. Now. Tomorrow will mark 3 weeks since I've been at Ava's, and I haven't heard Graham's voice since the day he dropped me off at the airport. He called me once last week, but I didn't answer my phone. I texted him and told him I needed time to think. He responded and said, "Call me when you're ready." He hasn't texted me since then, and I'm still not ready to call him. As miserable as I feel inside, I really do like it here at Ava's. I can't determine if I like it because it's new and different, or if I like it because I feel further away from all of my problems. I haven't done a lot of sightseeing because of the recovery. My body is still sore and weaker than what I'm used to. But Ava and Reed's home is beautiful and relaxing, so I don't mind spending most of my time here. It's been so long since Ava and I had quality time together, I've actually been enjoying myself, despite the circumstances of my marriage. I do miss Graham, though. But I miss the Graham that was married to the happier version of myself. We fit together better in the beginning than we do now. I know that's because my piece of the puzzle has changed shape more than his. But even though I feel more at fault over the downfall of our relationship, it still does nothing to change the trajectory. This trip has been exactly what my soul was craving, a much-needed change of pace. I spoke openly to Ava about everything going on with Graham for the first time. The thing I love most about Ava is that she listens more than she gives advice. I don't really want advice. Advice won't change how I feel. Advice won't change the fact that I can't get pregnant. Advice won't change the fact that Graham said he was devastated he hasn't become a father yet. The only thing advice is good for is to pad the esteem of the person giving it. So, instead of advice, she's just given me distraction. Not only from Graham, but from our mother. From work, from infertility, Connecticut, my whole life.
What about this color? Ava holds up a swatch of yellow paint.
Too canary, I say. She looks down at the swatch and laughs.
That's actually what it's called. Canary.
Reed walks to the stove and lifts a lid from a pot, taking a whiff of the sauce he's been cooking. I'm sitting on the bar with Ava, looking through possible wall colors for their nursery.
If we'd just find out what we're having, it would make this process a lot easier, Reed says, putting the lid back on the pot. He turns off the burner.
Nope, Ava says, sliding off the bar. We decided we aren't finding out. We only have 10 weeks left. Be patient.
She gathers 3 plates from the cabinet and walks them to the table. I take silverware and napkins to the table while Reed brings the pasta. Neither of them have made me feel as if I'm overstaying my welcome, but I'm starting to worry that I might be. 3 weeks is a long time to host someone. I'll probably fly home this week, I say, as I spoon pasta onto my plate.
Don't leave on our account, Reed says. I like having you here. Brings me a little peace of mind while I'm traveling.
Reed spends 2 or 3 nights a week away from home, and with Ava being pregnant, he worries about leaving her alone more than she wants him to. I don't know why my presence brings you peace of mind. Ava is braver than I am.
It's true, she says. One time, we went to a haunted house, and Freddy Krueger jumped out at us. Quinn pushed me toward him and ran back to the entrance.
Did not, I say.
I pushed you toward Jason Voorhees. Either way, I almost died, Ava says.
Do you think you'll fly back in 2 months, when Ava has the baby?
Of course I will.
Bring Graham this time, Reed says. I miss the guy.
Graham and Reed have always gotten along well, but I can tell by the look Ava gives me that she hasn't told Reed about Graham's and my issues. I appreciate that. I twist my fork in the pasta, reflecting on how lonely I've felt since Ava and Reed moved away from Connecticut, but this is the first time I've realized how much their move probably affected Graham, too. He lost a friend in Reed with their move. Probably his closest friend since Tanner. But he's never once talked about it, because my sadness fills our house from wall to wall, leaving no room for his sadness. For the rest of dinner, all I can think about are all the things Graham probably doesn't tell me because he doesn't want to put his sadness onto me. When we're finished eating, I offer to do the dishes. Reed and Ava are sitting at the table, poring over more color options for the nursery, when their doorbell rings. "That's weird," Ava says.
"Really weird," Reed agrees.
"Do you two never have visitors?" Reed scoots back from the table.
"Never. We don't really know anyone here well enough yet for them to come to our house."
He walks to the door, and Ava and I are both watching him when he opens it. The last person I expect to see standing in that doorway is Graham. My hands are submersed in suds, and I remain frozen as Reed and Graham hug hello. Reed helps him with his suitcase, and as soon as he walks through the door, Graham's eyes go in search of mine. When he finally sees me, it's as if his whole body relaxes. Reed is smiling, looking back and forth between us expectantly, waiting on the surprised reunion. But I don't run to Graham, and he doesn't run to me. We just stare at each other in silence for a beat. The beat is a little too long enough for Reed to sense the tension in this reunion. He clears his throat and takes Graham's suitcase.
I'll put this in the guest room for you.
I'll help you, Ava says, quickly standing.
When they've both disappeared down the hallway, I finally break out of my shocked trance long enough to pull my hands out of the water and dry them on a dish towel. Graham slowly makes his way into the kitchen, eyeing me carefully the whole time. My heart is pounding at the sight of him. I didn't realize how much I missed him, but I don't think that's why my heart is pounding. My pulse is out of control because his presence means confrontation. And confrontation means a decision. I'm not sure I was ready for that yet. It's the only reason I've still been hiding out at my sister's house halfway across the world from him.
"Hey,"
he says. It's such a simple word, but it feels more serious than anything he's ever said to me. I guess that's what almost 3 weeks of not speaking to your husband feels like.
"Hi,"
my reply comes out cautious, but not as cautious as the hug I eventually give him. It's quick and meaningless, and I want a redo as soon as I pull away from him. But instead, I reach toward the sink and remove the drain. "This is a surprise." Graham shrugs, leaning against the counter next to me. He gives the kitchen and living room a quick once-over before bringing his eyes back to mine.
"How are you feeling?"
I nod. "Good. I'm still a little sore, but I've been getting plenty of rest. Surprisingly, I do feel good. I thought I might be sadder than I am, but I've realized I had already come to terms with the fact that my uterus was useless, so what does it matter that it's no longer in my body?" Graham stares at me in silence, not really knowing how to respond to that. I don't expect him to, but his silence makes me want to scream. I don't know what he's doing here. I don't know what I'm supposed to say. I'm angry that he showed up without warning, and angry that I'm happy to see him. I wipe my hand across my forehead and press my back into the counter next to him.
"What are you doing here, Graham?"
He leans into me, looking at me sincerely.
"I can't take this another day, Quinn."
His voice is low and pleading.
"I need you to make a choice. Either leave me for good or come home with me."
He reaches for me, pulling me to his chest.
"Come home with me,"
he repeats in a whisper. I close my eyes and inhale the scent of him. I want so bad to tell him I forgive him that I don't even blame him for what he did. Yes. Graham kissing someone who wasn't me is the single worst thing he's done during our relationship. But I'm not completely innocent in this situation. Forgiving him isn't even what I've been worried about. I'm worried about what happens after I forgive him. We had issues before he kissed another woman.
We'll still have those same issues if I forgive him.
That night in the car, before the miscarriage, Graham and I fought about the affair. But as soon as we open this floodgate tonight, that's when the real fight will happen. That's when we'll talk about the issues that caused all the other issues that led to our current issues. This is the talk I've been trying to avoid for a couple of years now. The talk that's about to happen because he just flew halfway around the world to confront me. I pull away from Graham, but before I can speak, Reed and Ava interrupt us, but only momentarily. "We're going out for dessert," Ava says, pulling on her jacket. Reed opens the front door.
"See you two in an hour."
He closes the door, and Graham and I are suddenly alone in their house, half a world away from our home, half a world away from the comfort of our avoidance. "You must be exhausted," I say. "Do you want to sleep first or eat?"
"I'm fine," he says quickly.
I nod, realizing just how imminent this conversation is. He doesn't even want food or water before we do this. And I can do nothing but stand here like I'm trying to decide if I want to talk it out or run from him so we can continue to avoid it. There's never been so much tension between us as we contemplate our next moves. He eventually walks to the table. I follow him, taking a seat across from him. He folds his arms over the table and looks at me. He's so handsome. As many times as I've turned away from him in the past, it's not because I'm not attracted to him. That's never been the issue. Even now, after a full day of travel, he looks better than he did the day I met him. It always works that way with men, doesn't it? They somehow look manlier into their 30s and 40s than they did in the pinnacle of their youth. Graham has always taken good care of himself. Still, like clockwork, he wakes up every day and goes for a run. I love that he stays in shape, but not because of the physical attributes it's given him. My favorite part of him is that he never talks about it. Graham isn't the type to prove anything to anyone or turn his fitness routine into a pissing match with his friends. He runs for himself and no one else, and I love that about him. He reminds me a lot in this moment of how he looked the morning after we got married. Tired. Neither of us got much sleep the night of our wedding, and by morning, he looked like he'd aged 5 years overnight. His hair was in disarray, his eyes were slightly swollen from lack of sleep, but at least that morning, he looked happy and tired. Right now, he's nothing but sad and tired. He presses his palms and fingertips together and brings his hands against his mouth. He looks nervous, but also ready to get this over with.
"What are you thinking?"
I hate the feeling I'm experiencing right now. It's like all my worries and fears have been bound together in a tight ball, and that ball is bouncing around inside of me, pounding against my heart, my lungs, my gut, my throat. It's making my hands shake, so I clasp them together on the table in front of me and try to still them. "I'm thinking about everything," I say, "about where you went wrong, where I went wrong." I release a quick rush of air. "I'm thinking about how right it used to feel, and how I wish it was still like that."
"We can get back to that, Quinn. I know we can."
He's so hopeful when he says it. And naive. How?
He doesn't have an answer for that question. Maybe that's because he doesn't feel broken.
Everything broken in our marriage stems from me, and he can't fix me. I'm sure if he could somehow fix our sex life, that would be enough to appease him for a few more years. "Do you think we should have sex more often?" Graham almost looks offended by my question. "That would make you happier, right?" He traces an invisible line on the table, looking down at it until he begins to speak.
"I won't lie and say I'm happy with our sex life, but I'm also not going to pretend that's the only thing I wish were different. What I want more than anything is for you to want to be my wife."
"No, what you want is for me to be the wife I used to be. I don't think you want me as I am now." Graham stares at me a moment.
"Maybe you're right. Is it so bad that I missed it when I was convinced that you were in love with me? When you would get excited to see me, when you wanted to make love to me because you wanted to, and not because you just wanted to get pregnant?"
He leans forward, pegging me with his stare.
"We can't have kids, Quinn. And you know what?
I'm okay with that. I didn't marry you for the potential kids we might have had together one day.